Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. This podcast is focused on navigating and adopting innovation in a post-pandemic world, from the 2023 DPharm Disruptive Innovations to Modernized Clinical Research Conference. For more information on the DPharm Conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, visit dpharmconference.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you and enjoy the podcast.
Well, thank you. You saw our introduction here talking about navigating and adapting innovation in a post-pandemic world. When I agreed to do this, I did not realize that it was going to be morning with the Kramers. So, you know, Amy slid in there between my two talks here, and she spells her name differently, but she works with my sister. So, anyway. So we have several questions, and we're going to start with Ken, I think. And we hope that Ken can talk about how pharma has innovated in clinical operations in response to the pandemic. Along with that, adapting what was necessary to make a pivot based on the pandemic and potentially other pandemics to meet the requirements of patient safety, continuity of therapy, endpoints, and so forth, and how we can apply new innovative execution models into a broader scale and carry them over post-pandemic. So Ken, that's a lot of comments for you to make in 3 minutes.
I know there was a question in there somewhere. And I do want to mention, by the way, that that music that you just heard made us all feel like doing a line dance on our way up here, which is a metaphor for the remarkable way we as an enterprise coordinated our activity in a synchronous way. You know, the more time that passes since the pandemic, now that we're in the wake of it, the greater the distance we're all taking. We are at a higher level with a bird's eye view of so many of the remarkable things that we accomplished together. And just to name a few, and I'm sure there are others that many of you are well aware of, it was an incredible enterprise-wide adaptation and a pivoting, all with the effort to ensure patient safety and to preserve research continuity and research integrity. It was remarkable the way we mobilized as an enterprise in a very open and agile way. A tremendous amount of flexibility, open communication. We leveraged a variety of technologies and approaches that allowed us to meet our singular focus, which was to really develop great science with a synchronous and coordinated set of operating activities and a variety of stakeholders behind it. We found ways to de-risk our activity. Our regulatory agency colleagues were remarkably responsive and accommodating and proactive. We saw certainly so many oversight mechanisms that adapted as well. We also had additional funding provided by the federal government, which obviously helped to de-risk a lot of the operating activity as well. So just truly a remarkable and unprecedented approach that we took to nimbly operating to address this critical global need and global pandemic.
Just to follow up, I think, on Ken's comments, a few of the things, especially as it related to the pandemic and therapies, helped in these Bayesian designs, platform designs, and so forth. So the health authorities understand that much better than they did at one point.
Lynn, so, if I could just make one more comment, I want to mention that we, as an enterprise, something we don't often focus on, we distributed accountability. Instead of the typical centralized way that we interact with contracted service providers, we really pushed accountability out in a very decentralized way, and that was critical as well.
So next, Andy and Bari, Can you each share some of the innovations that you all will be taking forward in the future, I assume?
There you go, Phil.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Andy. So the pandemic was a time period where I think we had to think very fast. And we'd been all in this room thinking about what can we do differently for decades, actually. And it really just took an occasion, unfortunate as it may have been, like a pandemic, to really get us thinking about how we actually take those things that are different and employ them rapidly and effectively. And things like digital technologies, many of us were using some of them, but not to the degree that we're using them today. Mobile health, home health, things that we may have employed to a small degree in our trials are part of what Regeneron, for my organization, has taken forward in everything we're doing. We're considering our trial design in terms of how we set it up so that we can employ all of the opportunities to make things easier, to collect more data, to have better data quality. And some of those are the things I mentioned, but I think one of the things that, you know, it actually relates to the previous discussion on data interoperability, we want to actually make this more streamlined as well. How do we get this faster? And so remote monitoring, reducing the amount of time we need to be at sites, reducing the amount of resource that it takes to actually review data, we're fully embracing how to minimize the need for monitoring, what the CRA of the future looks like, EHR to EDC, really using that to have the right data quality with less effort at the end of the day. And so that's something that we were able to employ because we had to, couldn't get to sites. And so now we're saying, well, do we need to? And how often? And how can we do this better than we were doing it in the past? So those are some of the things that I think are taking us into the future, as well as the use of technology and real-world data. I think those are things that, again, we had our eyes on, we were thinking about, but we weren't employing as much as we are now because of some of the opportunity. I think we all took the opportunity to engage in new ways of working that now have shown, well, we can do this. And so why don't we?
Right, great. I want to remind people that a company like ours works in 50 to 60 different countries, pretty much as many tables as there are in this room, and tables have different numbers of people at them. And the pandemic was totally episodic. So we may have had a pandemic in that part, you know, and nothing happening in this part, and then something pops up here. And so we adopted an approach that said we continue with business. We had gone through a corporate cyber attack about 2 or 3 years before the pandemic, and we had built incredibly robust business continuity plans, which we invoked as we needed. And the model I shared yesterday to the audience was one of standardization as the platform for innovation. And as this episodic event happened, first in China, Southeast Asia, then it went to Italy, and then it moved around the globe, by the time we'd got to US and Latin America, China had recovered. Mm. So what we looked at is we looked at 6-7 years of standardization. We said, standardization got us so far. What we need to do now is have a standard model where everyone knows how to work, but variants in each place where you need to adapt. So in China, we adapted our procedures and ways of working, but left them the same. We did not amend a single protocol. We did not stop a single protocol, and we had project continuity. And in the entire pandemic, we did not miss a single database lock, and we lock about 300 a year. So it worked. But what did we do that we adopted that was different? So we became much more flexible in our way of operating. We went away from the rigidity of standardization into flexibility. Our monitors were the key to success, but monitoring and sites have to work together. And one of the innovations we adopted and have used is the EISF, and you heard from Florence yesterday, and I'm not trying to do a plug, but that was a godsend for sites, and it was a godsend for our monitors who could now work remotely. We looked at remote monitoring, and really we've embedded that and adapted our monitoring approaches. And then I think the home nursing was something we really looked at carefully, but not a single home nursing group could actually do this in a cost-effective way for us, and none of them could give surety of supply. And it was very difficult. I'm not criticizing them, but you imagine nurses being asked to go to homes in a pandemic was a very difficult thing. So home nursing is something that's evolved, and particularly the data capture and how you can automate that into data systems. What we also did is we decentralized some of the procedures in labs and imaging, to some extent. But what we've seen from the IQVIA Institute is 98% of cancer patients are back at site. It's just staggering to hear that. We haven't forced a decentralization of procedure. We've let it flow depending on the project need. So, you know, if you have advanced cancer and looking at imaging every 3 months, that gets done at a cancer center. If you're in an adjuvant setting where you're looking at, you know, you're disease-free, so-called, and you're waiting for recurrence in 5 to 10 years, we can do that in a remote setting. So more flexibility, different approaches to home nursing, different approaches to the clinic, and then thought a lot about drug supply and how we manage that to get that in patients' hands more efficiently. Those are the predominant changes. And a flexible mind that one size does not fit all.
Thank you. And lastly, we'll try to get Janice involved here. The question for you would be, how have you seen these established neutral platform systems for multi-stakeholder collaboration like Transcelerate offer opportunities to foster innovation?
Sure. Thanks, Lynn. And, you know, I think as Ken said at the beginning, pandemic should not be such a distant, you know, memory for us at this point, right? But bring yourself back to March 2020, and times were chaotic, and you just heard from Andy and Barry as individual sponsors, the challenges they were trying to navigate. So through Transcelerate, I would say, and Barry and Andy know this firsthand because they're on our board, almost immediately through Transcelerate as a platform, our member companies got activated. And what they did was we had boots on the ground leaders really are running these trials around the globe, really coming together on a weekly basis, sharing real-time learnings on what's working and what's not working around the globe. And I've been doing this for a long time, and many of you are probably in the audience and you were part of those conversations. It was really remarkable to see when we're all truly coming together in that world health crisis, and we're all united with the mission to continue to serve the patients, how all of our member companies coming together. Those were early calls, late evening calls. Sometimes we have over 100 colleagues coming together across our 20 member companies just sharing real time around what technologies were working, these novel technologies and processes were working. Almost every week it felt like there was a new set of regulatory guidance popping out, and how are we as sponsors operationalizing them, and what was working, what was actually the feedback coming from the local health authorities, and then also most importantly, what are we hearing from the patients as we try and continue to serve them and get the medicines and treatments to them. So for me, that was really something really remarkable for us to see coming through during the early weeks of the pandemics. And then secondly, true to Transcelerate who we are, we have been as an organization through colleagues from member companies developing practical implementable tools and templates that are really aimed to ease the operational hurdles. So it was very just timely for us to get activated. We were actually reached out by some governmental agencies and health authorities to help package up those assets that we have as a non-for-profit to help enable or accelerate some of the platform trial activities that were being initiated. And I have to also build on Ken's point. What I saw throughout those early months, really the openness and willingness from health authorities was remarkable. And really just a ability to leaning in to have conversations with sponsors. In fact, I have to acknowledge FDA, we have been working on a solution around protocol deviation toolkit. That was in process, we were engaging feedback from health authorities. They were the ones that encouraged when the pandemic hit, perhaps together we can accelerate the launch of such a toolkit and to make it available to the public, not just to the Transcelerate member companies. So it was really incredible to see that level of collaboration as a neutral party, as a trusted platform, as Transcelerate coming together, and then really working across the ecosystem, again, above and beyond the sponsors. And really, I think at the end of the day, Lynn, we brought a new sense of norm, right? It's sort of elevating an operational, foundational new norm for that as individual member companies continue to innovate on the scientific aspects.
Just to follow up, we have noticed a somewhat different attitude towards some of those corrective processes by different regulatory bodies across the globe. US was very forward in that regard. EU maybe not quite so, or at least more recent audits suggest that they backslid in their thinking. Any comment on that?
I mean, you know, there are so many geographic differences and regulations, right? I can't speak for the regulators, but I think, again, going back to the comment that was made earlier, you know, the patient's expectations of us certainly have changed. We're seeing what we could do in times of crisis. I think what I'm seeing is that as long as from a sponsor-specific discussion, which I don't get involved at the project or trial level, but I think Marsha Sampson yesterday in the afternoon session said it perfectly, have those conversations early on, because certainly from as Transcelerate, as long as you're willing and open to having those conversations with health authorities and really having an open mind, and you can explain your rationale behind it, I haven't seen drastic resistance.
It's more on the audit front I was asking versus the actual regulator.
I have firsthand experience that countries like China have reverted back to the pre-pandemic approach, on-site monitoring, all of those things. Other countries have been more flexible, but it varies. And the question we ask ourselves is who makes these decisions? And really, sites have choices now. And Jamie highlighted this earlier on. The sites are really stressed on resourcing and what they will and won't do. They are rejecting complex protocols. They are rejecting sponsors who come with over elaborate ways of working and do not facilitate. And they are demanding newer ways of working. And guess what? They're not to put more electronic systems in. There's a rejection on electronic systems to get simplicity and standardization. And that's a real challenge for us as we look at the therapeutic area. So we have to think broadly of how much work can we get in this resource-constrained environment of the United States. And that's made us think about going to new theaters of operation and expanding.
I would just add, too, I think one of the opportunities is really to engage not just on a protocol project-specific level with regulators, but on guidances. Regulatory bodies are interested in hearing from companies and the people who actually do the work day in and out how the guidance affects, or the guidances they're creating affect the work we do. And I think we have to be much more proactive as leaders in the industry to really share our insights with regulators who really have a view, but may not understand how things truly operate when you're working with sites, when you're dealing with protocols, et cetera.
One quick comment on the quality is audit has now got back in the field. So I'm thrilled our auditors are back in the field. And they're finding things that lapsed in the COVID period, the 2-3 years where we reduced monitoring, couldn't get there in certain areas. The inspections are following, okay, so as we file. But we've had more time in the inspection side from regulators because we typically only get inspected when we filed a new agent. And in that time, we've been able to, you know, catch up on TMFs and those types of things. So it'll be interesting to see what the results of inspections are. Perhaps in a year from now, we could have a group to discuss that.
Thank you. That's a good comment. So next, Ken. I'd like, since you have access to the study data at the Tufts Center, could you comment on any shifts in operating models and execution models that you've seen over the last year versus before?
Wow, we could spend a whole day talking about that.
3 minutes, though.
And very quickly, I just wanted to throw out a data point for everyone that really builds on a comment Andy made, that over 3,000 sites, typically low volume, like one trial a year, minimal infrastructure, have exited the drug development enterprise and have yet to return. And that was all occurring as the pandemic unfolded. I think, Lynn, the key with all this, and I think it's something we all realize, but we don't talk about it here at DPharm, and that is that we don't innovate particularly well. In fact, the typical disruptive innovation takes about 6 years for a single company to ultimately fully implement, and about 20 years for an enterprise as a whole to implement it. So that's a sort of a way of describing why we're not picking up on real improvements in the performance of the variety of executional models that we're studying today. In fact, in almost every case, our trials are taking longer, our recruitment and retention effectiveness is worse. So we're not really seeing the impact of a lot of the hybrid and custom approaches that are being implemented. We hope to pick up on that, but that length of time that it takes for a single organization to really adapt and fully implement an innovative approach or approaches takes a really long time.
Barry and Andy, back to you all. This question's about the patient drivers for participating in clinical trials and adaption of new technologies that may assist in patient retention, access, et cetera.
So I'll be a little provocative. I do think, and I said it yesterday in one of the panels, that innovation is not only technology. And I think one of the things we lost in the pandemic was the ability, or at least for some period of time, to build relationships between the sites and the patients, yeah. Between the sponsors and the sites. And to me, one of the things that we need to work on is how to better build relationships. Now, a few minutes ago, I just said we want to reduce monitoring and not be at sites as much. Doing that, right? But I do think there's a real opportunity to remember how we essentially build those relationships and build them with the patients, whether they're at a site all the time or not. And Andy said it before, many of our trials require patients to be there. The procedures we need to do require patients to be there. So the idea that everything is decentralized, I don't think is, you know, has panned out to the degree that we may have anticipated or maybe wanted, maybe didn't. But I do think the ability to build relationships is really important. And we've been doing a host of user experience on the systems that we use, user experience on how people feel when they're in a trial, really trying to understand what does it mean to the patient? What does it mean to the site coordinator when she's using 17 systems to do one trial? How do we adapt and utilize that information and some of the information that Ken's group provides to all of us to really shape how we do things differently? And I think that is a little bit of the game changer in really understanding through asking, right? How it works for the patient and building those relationships better.
Briefly, sites work with patients. We don't work with patients. So we've enabled and encouraged sites to look at new ways. E-consent was one that sites adopted, different forms and ways of consenting. That was great. And they engaged patients through telephone and different mechanisms. And what we found is things like our HIV trials recruited quicker in the pandemic than typically. It was amazing. Where we didn't recruit quickly was in elective surgeries, and that's where patients had choice. And we couldn't influence that. That was just around risk and everything. So, and one last thing is that sites struggled, and many of them were losing money and everything. And we actually propped up sites. We looked at financial models in which we could keep them opening, particularly infectious disease sites who were shifting resource to the pandemic, but were reliant on clinical trials. And I think that's keeping those sites active and open and communicating with patients led to really enhanced recruitment in particularly in infectious disease trials, surprisingly. So that was a wake-up call for us, is patients are connected to doctors in certain disease areas, and we should never forget that the PIs are really important, and so are their coordinators.
Janice, quickly, you have 1 second. could you comment on DCT technologies, and are they truly patient-centric?
I feel like you're ending with a trick question there. But thank you for the question. I will say it should be, right? But building, maybe just tying it all together, DCT, we get really excited about the technology. It's not about the technology, is it? And it has to be fit for purpose. And Andy just talked about, depending on the patient population, the disease area, how do we really bring it back to be patient-led design from a design and execution perspective. Yesterday's panel, we talked about there's a real opportunities around designing trials that are data-driven. I would encourage you to think about the real innovation now for all of us who are in this industry to think about the real innovation is around how do we design trials that are patient-led, that are patient preference-driven. This is not easy, right? Building patient trust relationships, it's not easy. But we shouldn't, I had a conversation yesterday. I think Jamie, just at the kickoff, talked about all the pressures we're facing in this industry. Pressure is a privilege. And remember what a privileged position we are in to be part of this ecosystem, in this industry, to serve the patients. If we can just bring it all back to being, it's about the patients, I think we can go far. We have a lot of work ahead still, but I think it should be patient-centric, but it's not about the technology.
So I think I'll wrap it up with that. During our conversation, we had a lot of responses that I think got at my last question. So I think thank you all very much. And thank you all for following the timeline as closely as possible for people like us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more information on the DFARM conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, visit dfarmconference.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you for listening.